I'm Meredith.
And I'm Robin.
And this is My TV Family. This is part two of our coverage of the 2019 Austin Film Festival.
Welcome back. As Meredith mentioned, today we're continuing our recap of our time at the Austin Film Festival. If you haven't already, please check out part one of our festival coverage. But here comes part two.
Last episode we focused on TV creators we got to see and interview. And this time we're talking about some amazing films we saw and sharing our interviews with the cast members and creatives from some of our favorites.
That's right. Shall we get started?
Let's do it.
Okay. So the first film that we got to preview was called Pipe Dreams. Oh. And that is a documentary about the world of competitive pipe organ players.
So good.
And I know we've talked about this before, and several of the filmmakers we got to meet and interview at the festival talked about documentaries' ability and power to show you a world you wouldn't have normally gotten a glimpse into. And I don't know about you, but this was not a world that I got a glimpse into.
I definitely learned some things about the pipe organ.
Yeah, so it was very much in the same realm as Spellbound.
Yeah.
That kind of shed a light onto, or shone a light onto, spelling bees or wordplay, the competition about crossword puzzles.
Yes.
So kind of those films where you start out with a big group of people and it narrows down to the people competing to make the final round. So yeah, what did you think about Pipe Dreams, Meredith?
I loved it. I thought it was riveting right off the bat. I thought they did a really nice job at showing us like the different personalities and showing us about the organ itself, and then showing kind of how this world of pipe organ competition is like growing and changing.
Yep.
Which seems
there's
like
some money behind it, which yeah. was real interesting.
And we definitely had a favorite. I know the filmmaker probably wasn't allowed to choose a favorite, but we had a favorite, which was Al C from Texas.
Yeah, a local guy.
We were able to interview the director, producer, and filmmaker, Stacy Tenenbaum. So up next, you'll find hear our interview. You can also find Pipe Dreams on iTunes on November 19th.
Yeah, check it out. It's a good one. All right. Do you mind to introduce yourself and tell folks who you are and what you're doing?
So my name is Stacy Tenenbaum. I come from Montreal, Canada, so a long way. And my film is Pipe Dreams. It's screening here at the Austin Film Festival. And I'm the director and producer of the film.
Oh, many hats.
Yes.
We both really love the film. So, yeah,
thank you
for bringing that into our lives. And I think Meredith wanted to start out.
Yeah, like she said, we really enjoyed it. We were surprised by how riveting it was. Like, you guys did just such a wonderful job making this film. So I wanted to know, did you know a lot about the pipe organ before, or how much do you have to know before you start this documentary?
Well, actually, it was like I had a family friend who's the artistic director of the festival. And he invited me. It only started in 2008, but it became such a huge festival because of the amount of prize money they offer. So it became like a really big festival, attracting a lot of the top organists very quickly. So I went to the first one. He invited me, and I'm like, oh, 2.5 hours on a church bench listening to organ music. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to go, honey. And my husband's like, we have to go, you know. And then they projected the organist on a screen at the front of the thing that was part of the competition. And I'd never seen an organ being played, and I was like, oh my God, this is like the most insane instrument because of like the four keyboards
mm-hmm.
and their pedal board
and their
that they're
fingers.
Doing it all at the same time and all the buttons. It's super athletic. And then they were these young people, and I'm like, who does that? Like, how? So it just like immediately I got like totally into the organ and organ music. And also the music wasn't what I expected, because people expect it's going to be like what you hear at church.
Yeah.
But there's actually a lot of modern composers and like really cool. Yeah. Philip Glass, John Cage, Art Tatum, like those are all pieces that you'll hear in my film. Not the Philip Glass, but the John Cage and Art Tatum. So I was like, oh, this is like really a cool instrument I know nothing about. So I keep on telling people it's like the hipster instrument waiting to be discovered. Because yeah. it's also handcrafted, which is really cool. And there's a whole bunch of nerdy acoustic stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a really cool instrument. So if people love music and they think they're into music, then they should definitely know about the organ.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I feel like I learned a lot about the organ. And I was interested to know that, like, the pipe organ is not around, available across the world. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I thought that the variety of competition spaces was also really challenging for the performers as well.
Super challenging, because each organ is built for its space. Right. So it's like a work of art that, like, it's actually the organ and the space that make the music, which is really cool. I told you there's a lot of nerdy stuff involved in this.
Stacey, that's beautiful.
So yeah, so there's a lot involved in each, and so they have to learn each organ before they can play it. And they all have different, like, keyboards and different layouts. It's really complicated. So before each of the rounds, they had to learn that particular organ and then be able to play it very quickly. So
that's wild.
It's a lot of stress during that competition. And you feel it during the film, I think.
So transition alert, speaking of stress, can you talk a little bit about challenges posed by doing this in real time? So choosing the performers and crossing fingers that they don't just completely crap out in the first round.
Yes.
And also the logistics involved of filming in all of these locations around the world.
Yeah, so I was really nervous about that, because as a filmmaker, first of all, there were only 20 people in the competition. And as a filmmaker, I'm used to, like, the world is my oyster.
Right.
I find the best characters wherever they are.
Now it's a numbers game.
Now it's like I got 20 people and they better be good. So I was, like, really blessed to have, like, these amazing characters, each one, like, looking different from the next and incredibly different personalities and brilliant and fantastic. But I was really nervous about getting rid of my whole cast at the first elimination round. It was, like, terrifying. So I actually filmed with 8 of them.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot more filming that I did that's not even in the film. Uh-huh. And it was, I traveled to many, many countries, as you see in the film.
Yeah.
And it was compressed into a period of 4 months. So it was, like, 2 days in China, 1 day in New Zealand, 1 day in Australia. Like, it was just a total marathon. And then the competition itself is 14 days long. So you don't see that in the film either. They play actually 2.5 hours worth of music, each of them.
Oh my goodness.
So it's like outrageous. No, it's so crazy. So for 14 days, we had 2 crews running the entire 14 days without a break. So it was just really intensive filming.
Yeah, and that's a lot of bananas they have to eat.
A lot of bananas. I bought a lot. The bananas thing totally tripped me out. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Because I think it's like, I don't know, it's a musician thing, because they get stage fright, which I didn't know about, because I'm not a musician at all. Like,
yeah.
At all. So I'd never experienced someone having stage fright. It's terrible. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So awful. And then they would eat these bananas to calm their nerves, but I think it gave them, like, a shot of energy, because they weren't able to eat before because they were so nervous.
Yeah.
So then I guess it was like a last minute boost of some kind of, you know, but I thought the banana thing was hysterical.
I did too. Like, every shot there was, like, you could find the banana when they were preparing. It was great.
It's real. That's not planted. That's all documentary.
No, it felt very authentic. Don't worry. So I don't really even know how to ask this question, but I was curious about how you shoot the sound, like how you get the sound, because I don't think in an organ you can plug in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get it with the acoustics of the big churches?
This was a big thing for me, and I'm really into sound, and
okay.
I knew for this film it would be really important. And I wanted people to feel like they were in the churches, so I actually got a special microphone. This is also nerdy sort of sound stuff.
You're speaking to the right people.
Okay. So I got a special microphone. It's an ambisonic microphone. So it has 4 microphones that are together. So kind of, you know, 360 cameras?
Yeah.
It's kind of the same concept. So it's 360 sound.
Oh, okay.
And we would set it up in the middle of the church, and then it would record it as if you were feeling like you were in the church. So that is what I did for almost all of our shoots, was this special microphone, in addition to shotgun mics and lavs and the regular stuff that people use. But it's really interesting, because when you're close to an organ, and you might have noticed in certain scenes, you hear the clicking. They have like a lot of mechanical clicking sounds.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't necessarily want that as, like, part of the music. Like, when you're in a church, you don't hear those clicks and clacks, right? But when you're up close to the organ, you do. So it was kind of like balancing that reality of being close to the organ and hearing that very mechanical sound, which I think is kind of cool.
I think it's cool.
Because it's a big machine. It's like a huge, complicated, crazy machine. And when you hear that clicking and clacking, it's kind of like, oh yeah, this is a machine. It's cool. But obviously when they're making music, I wanted it to be beautiful and feel like you were in the audience rather than up with the performers.
Yeah, but I do like that you get those shots of them up close and, like, feeling like you're right there watching them. Yeah. Like, when the one guy's, the stops or whatever.
Oh, my goodness.
Didn't pull out. I don't know. Oh, all the terminology. But we were right there watching that, and you could watch him, his frustration.
Oh, my God. We had such great access. I mean, really, it was amazing what they let us do.
Yeah. How dramatic tension, that moment.
It was awful. So, it's terrible.
Yeah, but getting to hear those sounds and being a part of it, I think really helps you be there with the competitors.
Yeah, that was a nightmare scenario. Like, anyone who's in a competition and something goes so horribly awry, it's just like, oh, terrible.
And he was so young. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, watch the movie, everyone. We wanted to talk about our Texas guy, Alcee. We adored him. Such a star. And there's a point in the film where he says he sure would like a person of color on the jury. Mm-hmm. And I think to your point about being able to see that video feed, you know, you see the person performing. It's not blind. Can you talk a little bit about, to the extent that you can, diversity and inclusion in this field, in these competitions?
Well, the Oregon world is a little complicated because it's getting older and older. So these young people are actually a bit of it's a new thing, right? It's a new generation of organists, which I found interesting to show in the film because usually you see organists and they're white and old, right? I mean, that's pretty
that
much
that old,
it.
I mean, the older woman that you show, oh my gosh,
And also, you know, there were a lot more men than women. So so Alcee was a wonderful kind of, because he comes from a different background. And what was interesting,
he's from Texas, y'all.
He's from Texas. Love him. And he was like, we couldn't afford an organ in our church. And that's a really huge thing. You don't think about it, right? It's like, oh, okay, certain churches can't afford to have organs. And that's like, he didn't grow up with that. And so he really had to work to be able to learn this instrument. Like, it's an incredible story that
he talks about.
Yeah, it's just so great, and he's so talented, and then he brought his, gospel and jazz roots to the competition, which was really amazing, and he's just a wonderful and supremely a talented individual. I mean, he's incredible, so I love him too.
Yeah, and I think that's really important that you show, the lack of access and, what that means and how hard you have to work to overcome certain barriers. I think maybe not the intent of the whole film, but was a really interesting part of it. So I appreciate that. So one thing we ask all our guests, and so I know you are out there making films, but we're curious of what you're watching, if you find time to watch other films or TV or listen to podcasts.
Yeah. Of course I do. Not just organ music.
Okay.
No, I actually love film. I go to many, many films. I watch a lot of documentaries as well. But I have a really quirky taste. I mean, I make quirky films and I have quirky taste in films.
Yeah,
so everything
awesome.
From the Ten Commandments to True Romance to and so many great documentaries. I mean, I've been seeing quite a few. I saw Cowboys here at the festival. It's so beautiful. I love for me, documentary, it lets you into this world that you might never experience. I mean, whether it's organists or cowboys, is for me the kind of the same thing. It's that special treat to be able to learn about something that you don't know about and to just see the beauty of it. And so, it's really fun.
Where can people find the documentary?
Yes, the film's actually doing really well, so I'm very happy about that. So it's going to be coming out on iTunes and I think Amazon Prime and a whole bunch of other things online.
Okay.
November 19th, and then it's also going to be airing on Independent Lens PBS in June. Ooh. So that's very exciting for me. It's a little bit of a shorter version that's airing on PBS, which was kind of interesting to cut down the film. But it's good. It was a good lesson and a good thing to do, and I love both versions. They're really both great, so I'm really happy about it. So a lot of Americans will get to see the film all across the country.
Well, you have two recommendations from us.
Thank you.
Wonderful, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, our next film is When We Last Spoke. This film won the Austin Film Festival's Texas Independent Feature Award, so congrats to y'all on that.
Congrats.
This is a story about two sisters who are abandoned by their mother and raised by their grandparents in a town called Fireside. It is adapted from a novel written by Marcy Hanna.
Mm-hmm. And it stars some of our favorite TV heavy hitters. I could not believe all of the big names that were in this movie. Cloris Leachman, Corbin Burnson,
one of my very favorites from LA Law fame, Melissa Gilbert. From Little House on the Dang Prairie, Meredith.
Yes, chock full.
I mean, and we were super appreciative of friend of the pod, Alicia Fusting, for helping to arrange our interview with the crew. And we had a chance to chat with author Marcy Henna, actress Alicia Fusting, and director Joanne Hawk. All right. Hey, everyone. Can you guys do a quick intro, names and who you are, what you do?
My name is Marcy Henna. I'm a novelist and wrote When We Last Spoke, the novel. And I'm local. I live in Austin, Texas.
Woo!
Hi, my name is Alicia Fusting. I'm an actress and I play adult Evangeline in Marcy's movie.
And my name is Joanne Hawk and I'm a writer-director. I wrote the screenplay along with two other people, Rick Eldridge and Jimmy Hager. And I also directed the feature.
Ooh, a few hats. We love to see it. So we just finished your film. Loved it so much. I have to say that Corbin Burnson and Melissa Gilbert was the hot romance I did not know that I needed in my life, but I ship it. Can you talk a little bit about this deep bench of talent and what it was like? Was there instant chemistry? Did you have to do exercises? How did you make the magic happen?
Well, it was kind of fun because Melissa and Corbin knew one another, but they'd never worked together. So it was an opportunity for them to kind of find the characters of Walt and Ruby, and I think they did a beautiful job. And one of the things that I've always kind of tried to go to in my head, and with Marcy's brilliant book, I was able to take those characters and have them leap off the page and onto the screen, is that mature love. This is not young love. They've been together 40 years. And their love is still very tangible, and you can feel it on the screen. And the fact that Corbin and Melissa were willing to go there, again, it's not lustful love. It's just pure love. And I think it was so much fun to let them dance, to let them reconnect on screen that way. And they were just lovely characters that they brought their A game to.
I love that. One of my favorite scenes is a scene of adult affection and love where they are dancing and kissing and the girls are just falling beside themselves. They're so grossed out, but it's very sweet and you do see the relationship that time has earned them. So yeah,
And that was so much fun to shoot because those little girls are charming. And I would have been, Marcy and I always talk about how we were very much alike to those young kids because that's how old we were in that era. And they're very relatable. And I remember getting grossed out when my parents were affectionate.
So you kind of spoke about one aspect of it, but like, how does having two timelines share or tell your narrative and tell your story?
Well, I thought it was important to have not only the 1967 period, but also to take it to their adulthoods, and so that because then they have this perspective of looking back, and you know, when you look back into something, it is a little bit different than the perspective of a child.
Yeah, gives you a different perspective. I like that.
And we have the adult Evangeline.
I know, I was going to say, Alicia, can you talk a little bit about, and anybody else can chime in too, but Fireside as a character in the book?
I very much was its own character, the town, and I mean, the cars, everything, and the people, and the love that the people have in that town. It was really beautiful to see that in a film, as you said it, because it was very much a character as itself.
Part of the I call it the folksy, approachable, small-town Americana, and how it has its own personality. We don't eat beets. I mean, I just love that. And then when Alicia said that line on screen, the audience just cracked up. We were just screening this last week at the Heartland Film Festival a week ago today. And when you pull into town and that sign is in the background, you go, I hate beets. And everybody just busts out laughing. So it's a personality town. And Marcy was able to build that in the page. And it was so much fun, again, to take that and literally have signs made in the town that say, we hate beets. Or we don't like beets. Yeah, so it was fun.
And I do hate beets.
Me too.
Yeah, same.
Marcy, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to see your words that you wrote for a novel up on the screen? And that
well, it, you know, it's a dream come true, and I have loved the journey. I always did see the Fireside series on television in my head, or in the theater. I always saw it that way, and I'm just so grateful that it happened. It has been joyful. I've loved the team I've worked with, and can't wait to do it again.
Yeah.
Here's a shameless plug, but Marcy's got a sequel called What Lies Ahead, and it's just a great joy to read. Alicia's reading it, and I'm reading it. So it's takes place right after when we last spoke. Oh, it wraps up.
Picks right up. So what do you think, and I would love to hear from any and all of you, as far as takeaways on lies and secrets, is it about your intent? Is it about the outcome? What do you think about families and secrets and lies? Evangeline, take it away.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, it's a heavy subject.
Sure.
But for me, whenever I was playing the adult version of her, I had to also try to dig how did that make her feel as a child and how that builds for her for a character. Because that's why she is the way that she is in the film. Not giving spoilers, but
no spoilers here.
But yeah, and it's little things like that. You have to see the younger version of her and just figure out why she is the way that she is and how these things affect her, because it very much people grow up because of the way that they dealt with life when they were younger. That is, I mean, hands down a big factor.
And I have to say, one of my favorite scenes in the film is when Evangeline is coming home, and I won't go into too much detail, but you just did a beautiful job looking out into the stars and kind of lamenting and reading poetry, and this is not a chick flick, but it is a woman's story with four very powerful leading women, and I do think that my cast captured it beautifully, and it was just so much fun to work with Alicia on that particular scene, as well as the other scenes, but that was one of my favorites.
That's so nice.
I know, thank you. That was one of my favorite scenes too. It's just sitting on the hood of this car and looking at the stars, and it was just being there. You know, it didn't feel pushed at all ever doing that scene, because it was just there. Everything, the whole environment around you, like
we had coyotes going whoo. Distance and like, wow, this is awesome, and you know, it was pretty remarkable. We were out in the middle of nowhere, yeah.
Wow, and I mean, such a full circle moment with the North Star, and just such a beautiful scene to watch as well. So,
wow, you really did watch the movie.
I told y'all, I paid attention, took notes, and everything. So, I think Meredith has one more question about, which is something that we ask everyone we interview, and I can't wait to see what you guys say. And then I'd love to share with folks where they'll be able to see the movie.
Okay, so we ask everyone, when you're not making films or writing books or acting, what are you watching on TV or movie? Do you find time to watch television, movies? You're shaking your head yes or no.
Oh, gosh. I just finished the Ken Burns Country Music. I thought that's phenomenal. It's just a great reflection of our history and our culture and how all these different styles of music blend. You don't think about R&B, everybody. I know, and it was just brilliant. And no spoiler alert here, but that will also play nicely into what Marcy and I are planning next. And so did the whole, and the historical nature of music, because Ruby Jimboree Cranborn is a fiddle player at the Grand Ole Opry, and so there's some neat crossover there. So that's one of my more recent shows. And then I'd watch Chernobyl, which is the most brilliant and best horror film ever. But it's true horror, and that's why it's even
why
more,
it's scary.
That's actually scary.
I love that. Alicia, what you watching?
I'm addicted to The Resident and A Million Little Things.
Oh, yeah, a lot of fans of that.
Very dramatic.
Yeah.
A little Matt Zuck reaction. Mm-hmm.
Some of my favorite series are Victoria, The Crown, and then I love to watch Anne with an E.
Oh, yeah. I liked Anne with an E, too.
You're classing up the podcast. And where can folks see the film?
Hopefully, people will be able to see it on television next year. So
yeah, Marcy can't tell too much on that, but yeah, we do have
it's in the works.
It's in the works.
So
yeah,
can we follow the movie on Twitter or
yes.
on
yes.
you have a website you want to plug?
Yes, yes, we do. We have a When We Last Spoke movie website, uh-huh. and there's an Insiders Club on that, and then I also have a website that has usually up to date happenings about the movie, and that can be seen at www.marcihenna.com.
Awesome. Wonderful. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our last interview is with Stefan Stuckert. He's a filmmaker and director for a documentary called Against the Tides.
Yep. This was another one of my favorites. I love a documentary, Meredith. This one kicked me right in the feels.
All the feels. So this documentary is about a woman named Beth French, who's a long-distance swimmer, and she decides to compete the extreme swimming challenge called Ocean 7.
We like something with what it is right in the title.
Yep.
Thanks, Beth.
And so Ocean 7 is a series of intense channel swims with varying degrees of crazy dangers. They had me at sharks.
Yep.
I was really into that. Boats, drifting tides. And she swims for hours and hours and miles and miles. Beth has also battled chronic fatigue syndrome since she was young and has a young son who's been diagnosed with autism.
The movie starts out with her fundraising and preparing and follows her as she travels the world with her son in tow and methodically checks off the channel swims one by one. And for each of the swims, they show you on the screen what the risks and hazards are for that particular swim. It's harrowing.
Yeah.
So no spoilers here, but the film does take a turn that is incredibly emotional. I think it has a lot to say about motherhood and responsibility and exactly what we owe to other people in our lives.
And Stefan Stuckert, the filmmaker, has a lot of really interesting things to say about the film, and you can listen to that interview here.
We are here with Stefan Stuckert from the new documentary Against the Tides. And we first wanted to ask a little bit more about what drew you to this topic, what drew you to the film?
What drew me to the film was the I with a friend of mine who I've been working with for a while. And we were thinking of making a film about swimming, mainly because I love swimming. Open water swimming. I learned swimming in the river, and I liked the idea of making a film about swimming, the immersion in a different space, in a different surrounding that is so different to walking on land. So that's what sort of fascinated me about swimming. And this friend of mine lives in the West Country of England, and Beth, our main protagonist, lives in a village near him. And so he talked to her about it, and then he talked to her about that we wanted to make a film about swimming, and then she mentioned this amazing challenge, Ocean 7, which we probably talk about in a little more.
Well, please talk a little bit more about
challenge itself. Yeah, so then he introduced me to her.
Okay.
And the first thing I remember when I went to see her, she opened the door and this pillow flew in my face, and that's how I was introduced to her son, Dylan, who is obviously also a crucial part of the film. And then we sat down for the whole afternoon, really talked about her plans, what she wanted to do, and then I got a better understanding of her, not just her challenge, which I knew a little bit about. Ocean 7 is an official challenge, extreme swimming challenge that consists of swimming across the seven most demanding or dangerous sea channels in the world. And Beth wanted to, at that time only a handful of people had ever completed it. And Beth wanted to be the first person to do it in a single year.
Oh my goodness.
So
yeah.
So we talked a lot about that.
Yeah.
And what it meant and the logistics and all of that. But then, so that was really already very interesting, this sort of epic adventure story, the heroic story in a way.
Of course.
But then we talked also about her backstory, which was she used to be in a wheelchair and as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So swimming and water was instrumental in her overcoming her illness, ME.
Yeah.
or chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
Which is a very, very little known or understood illness.
Yeah.
Although 17 million people suffer from it worldwide.
Wow.
So we talked a little bit about that and how swimming helped her and how she managed to overcome it, which was really amazing. And then also she's a single mother with an autistic son that homeschools her son because he doesn't, I mean, he's a wonderful boy, but he find it difficult schooling, traditional schooling.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden there was this character developing that had a really, really interesting backstory. It captures so many themes of education, of motherhood, of how to cope with difficulties, overcoming challenges. And then, so that was a sort of personal human story. And then on the other hand, you had this epic hero story.
Yeah.
So I thought these two elements would make a really fascinating film.
Yeah, you cover a lot of aspects and you think it's just going to be a swimming film and then there's just a lot of human interest in that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the challenges of filming that? So filming someone who's swimming for that long, like, can you talk about some of the challenges that you face in that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of challenges in documentary filmmaking, especially present tense documentary making, where you don't really know where it's going, what the ending is. So those are particular challenges. Financing, convincing people, investors. Yeah, so you tell people, I want to make this film, but she may not complete.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a difficult sale.
Yeah.
Sell. And then, of course, then there's a challenge of how to film it. Yes, exactly. I mean, we're trying to capture the emotions and struggles of somebody who spends most of their time looking down into the water.
Yeah.
So you can't see them. So that was a challenge of how do you visually address that.
Yeah. I think you've captured it beautifully. Some of the digital stills I've seen from below are so powerful and gripping. So I think you can definitely tell a story that way, but I can imagine from jellyfish to finance, everything was a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of challenges on her side in terms of setting up the challenge itself, which in a way they sort of mirrored the filmmaking process and her organizing the challenge. Mm-hmm. They sort of mirrored each other a little bit in terms of how to raise the funding. We were always very clear that there should be really straight line down. She does her swim and we're filming her doing that. Yeah, it wasn't like it should never be a promotional piece like where we do a behind the scenes or so this was literally was always meant to be a cinematic exploration of a woman trying this incredible feat.
Can you talk a little bit more about the pull that you see between motherhood and the desire to do this other, almost this thing that's bigger than yourself, and kind of how those things can be at odds with one another?
I mean, the perfect person to talk about it would be Beth.
Yeah.
Obviously, but she's not here, so I'll take a step. Yeah, I mean, for her it was always important to, and I think the film is in a way that it is not really, although it is of course about swimming a lot, but really it's her journey of getting to grips with her role as a mother, and for her it was always very important to not let her dreams go. So like her mother at the beginning is very clear, you shouldn't really be doing this, you should be there for your son and be at home, give him security and routine. But that wasn't for her. So I think that's for her, that was the main struggle, is to set to be the best mom she could be in the film. She says that I have to do what I need to do, what makes me happy. That's the best me I can be, and that's the best mother I can be. So that's a really important aspect. And the other aspect was that she wanted to show her son, set an example, inspire her son, who has his own struggles. He's an autistic boy, beautiful, wonderful boy, highly intelligent, But she wanted to set an example for him not to be defined by his condition. If he has dreams, and that he can achieve them, just like she managed to overcome her condition.
Yeah.
So there is it's a sort of two.
Dual.
Yeah, a dual.
Very powerful.
Yeah, it seems like there's just so many good, strong messages in the film. We have just one question we ask everyone we interview. And mm-hmm. So when you're not making amazing documentaries, what are you watching?
Oh, watching in terms of yes.
Film or television, or what are you listening to? Podcast?
Shameful television.
Oh, okay. Actually, I haven't watched very much television at all because it's so all-absorbing.
Yeah,
The film making first, and the post production, but now the distribution, the release of it. So it's pretty
all
encompassing.
We'll put you down for the Bachelorette.
For the what?
You watch the Bachelorette. We'll
yeah,
put you down for
yeah.
Reality TV.
But if I do watch, I watch. I watch. Netflix series, films.
Is there a documentary that has inspired you particularly?
Yeah, there's a lot of documentaries. I mean, I think what is this real story, this present tense documentary that I find is, well, I learned along the way, really. So that's what was really interesting. But the documentaries I like are quite more observational. The Wiseman documentaries, I mean, they go back to the 60s, but those I was always very interested in them. Just the idea of observing, which we try to follow in Against the Tides, and not really. Of course, you edit and you structure the narrative, but to be as much in the background as possible. But was very important for Against the Tides to let the story unfold, really, and it does unfold in in unexpected ways that we couldn't have anticipated from the start. So not to judge that too much and let it happen was really important. Yeah,
it sounds very difficult.
Yeah, it was very it's very challenging. It's like, well, it is like life in a way. You have to sort of lots of challenges, and you have to sort of cope with it. I mean, I was at a panel earlier here at the festival, and a panel of documentary filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a breadth of types of documentaries. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions was from the audience: was there any surprises in the making of it? And all three of them were really struggling to find. No, I mean, I set out to make this documentary, and then I sort of went ahead of making it. Now, of course, it depends on the type of documentary.
Sure.
But for us, it was completely different.
Everything was surprises.
Everything was surprising, and we could, it could go any which way, and of course, it has a lot of implications for investors.
Sure.
You know, how do you, especially this really big unexpected twist at the end. So it's really challenging. Yeah.
No spoilers here.
No spoilers. No.
Can you tell people where they can find the film?
Yeah, so at the moment we are in the UK. We are in cinemas. We are in the theatrical release. And we're now starting to work with digital distributors on finding broadcasters and digital platforms in the UK and Ireland. We have a world sales agent. And we are looking now for a North American distributor or a release strategy or a release platform.
Okay. So out there in listener land, if you're looking for distribution of the film, watch this space.
Yeah. So, but the best place to find the film at the moment is via our website. It's called againstthetidesfilm.com. And that's where all the, everything you want to know about the film will be under like synopsis, the team, the challenges itself,
trailer,
exactly. Yeah, photos of the making of it, screenings in the UK, feedback really important. I mean, we had so much positive, voluntary feedback via social media for people who saw the film in the UK. So that's also good to get a sense of how people have reacted to the film.
All right. So watch the movie, y'all.
Yeah. Thanks, Stefan.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, that concludes part two of our Austin Film Festival coverage. As a reminder, you can catch part one of our Austin Film Festival coverage in our previous episode. And if you want to connect with us, you can find us at MyTV Family Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you wouldn't mind, we'd love for you to rate, review, and subscribe.